The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Good week. It's gone. Next time we'll probably have another week, most of us, and a better chance to improve upon it if it wasn't very good. It should have been. It was Christmas. Hopefully, next week we'll start the new year and it will give at least many of us some things to be extra thankful for. I think that we're going to see a lot of unusual things in 2018, like war, blatant war. Unfortunately, lots of talk about it, lots of indications that Trump and his generals have decided that they are going to attack North Korea somehow, some way, to remove and neutralize their nuclear weapons program, not to mention their missile program. I don't think the Chinese are going to go for it, so when I say unusual, I think you're going to see the real potential of a major war between China, North Korea, which it will support, and the U.S. We'll have to wait and see, but it doesn't look good right now. I don't see any signs of a breakthrough. It looks like the energy and the stress, the anxiety, the threats are all just increasing. So we'll have to see. 2018 is just around the corner. This is our last program of the year, and we're going to spend it with a very interesting man who was on a couple of weeks ago and had so much to say. I invited him back, and he was kind enough to be able to come back. He is Dr. Raymond Keller, otherwise known as Cosmic Ray. And he spends a lot of time talking, researching about Venus, and certainly about Valiant Thor, Val Thor. You're going to talk about Ray with that in mind tonight, among other things. Hello, Ray. Welcome back. How are you?
Hello, Jeff. It's a pleasure. Doing
thank
fine,
you.
And it's always a great honor to be on your program.
Thank you very much. I was so tired today. Maybe it's end of the year tired. I took a nap about an hour ago, and I'm still a little fuzzy, so I can't get back with it. Now, the last time we talked, and we had photographs, and I hope all of you were there and we're able to look at it. If not, you can find the visit in the archives, and tonight we have photographs as well. If you look at the homepage under guests, and you look at the name Ray Keller, by all means, do look at that, because underneath his name, there are a number of photographs, links to click on, and I hope that all of you will be able to do that. The first story there, I think it's the first story, is entitled Cosmic Ray as the Wizard of Venus, and it is not an understatement. You know a lot about this story that is more than intriguing. Let me just back up a little bit, and if you would, for our listeners, let's recap what we covered last time in a couple of paragraphs or so, so everyone is back mentally up to speed.
Yes, we looked at the 13 July 1958 meeting of the Highbridge, New Jersey Flying Saucer Club with Howard Menger presiding, a contactee, probably right. The second most well-known following George Adamski, and the appearance at the club meeting of Valiant Thor and his crew.
Those pictures that we had up there, and I'm not sure if they're back up there tonight yet or not. It doesn't look like it, but let me, I'll have them put back up, actually. For our listeners, Valiant Thor is a fascinating man, Val Thor. Valiant Thor purportedly came here from the planet Venus, lived in the Pentagon for, what, three, 4 years, was it, before leaving?
Three years.
And Dr. Frank Stranges wrote a book about that called Stranger in the Pentagon, if I remember the correct title. And it is well worth reading. Now, when you look up the planet Venus on the internet, what do you find, Ray? What's the first thing you find? That beside it being utterly covered with clouds, what do we find?
Well, it'll tell you that the pressure is 93 atmospheres, and which is surprising because the very first probe to reach there, the Mariner 2 from the United States in 1962, said it was only about 6 to 8 times. And then every time they'd send one there, the number would keep going up incrementally. And until now, it's, now they're saying it's, closer to 100. So it's, and then they'll tell you that the temperature is, hot enough to melt lead, that it's, and that's another thing that keeps going up.
Right.
And actually, what it is they're measuring the ionosphere, so they're measuring electrical heat, which is different than solar heat.
Oh, interesting! It's the first I've heard of this. So it's not solar measurements we're hearing about; it's electrical heat. Now that's a whole different game.
Yes, and there's so many of these differences, the composition of the atmosphere.
It's all deceit. It's deception. And it's only growing. The cover-up is continuing. Here's a fun thing. This is from space.com. Ray, let me just read a little bit of this. Planet Venus. Let's see. Where's the factual part? It allegedly listens to science and reports what the facts are. Orbital characteristics, we don't want that. All right, here. Venus is the hottest world in the solar system. What, hotter than Mercury? Okay, come on. Although Venus is not the planet closest to the sun, its dense atmosphere traps heat in a runaway version of the greenhouse effect that warms the Earth. As a result, temperatures on Venus reach 870 degrees. That's Fahrenheit, right?
Yeah.
More than hot enough to, as Ray just said, melt lead. Probes that scientists have landed there have survived only a few hours before being destroyed. Venus has a hellish atmosphere as well, consisting mainly of carbon dioxide with clouds of sulfuric acid, and scientists have only detected trace amounts of water in the atmosphere. The atmosphere is heavier than that of any other planet, leading to a surface pressure 90 times, as Ray said, that of the Earth. Incredibly, however, early in Venusian history, the planet may have been habitable, according to models from NASA, and they say that these all basically are validated by the Goddard Institute for Space Studies and so forth. So if Venus was habitable or habitable at one point, what happened? That's the big question.
Yes. Well, Dr. Greenspoon at the I believe it's the University of Colorado, He said that Venus had paradisical conditions for about 2 billion years, even before life emerged on the Earth. Well, as we know, humankind has only been around for about 2.5 million years with Lucy and the Olduvai Gorge in Ethiopia.
Right.
So, you know, billion versus 2.5 million.
Of course.
Plenty of time for a Venusian advanced civilization to develop and move to higher levels.
Or another planet.
Or even underground.
Of course. Or to have learned how to re-terraform their planet into a safe and sane place to live. So, yeah. This is one of the interesting things about Venus is that there's very little written about it, very little talked about it by NASA or by space people in general. I mean, space people down here who study space, they just don't talk. It's like off limits almost. So that's suspicious in and of itself.
It is very suspicious, and I did some research into that area and found out that immediately following the Mariner 2.
Oh, we lost Ray. There he is. You there, Ray?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Hello.
Somebody's cutting in and out there into your service, so you're okay now. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yes, that following the Mariner 2, there was a rebellion in the ranks of scientists across the United States.
Uh-huh.
And they held a symposium where they challenged NASA, and these were people from University of in Texas, Ohio State University, even people from the Naval Observatory that had been doing research and soundings of Venus with weather balloons, high atmospheric. And what they had to say was that Venus could very well be in a abode of life, and they had their own conference where they offered their theories about life on Venus.
Oh, really? Now, when was this?
Yes, this was
approximately.
This was about the main symposium was about 2 years afterward that they uh-huh. got it organized, and. It was, see if I can find, oh, here it is. Okay, the four featured scientists, they had four featured scientists that were representatives. Dr. Lloyd V. Berkner of the Southwest Center for Advanced Studies in Dallas, Texas. Dr. Herbert Friedman of the Naval Research Laboratory. Dr. Harry H. Hess of Princeton University in New Jersey, and Dr. Gordon J.F. McDonald, a planetary physicist from the University of California at Los Angeles. All four had appeared before a closed-door session of the Senate Space Committee in the previous month, touting the glad tidings that Venus may not be a dead world after all.
What year was this again, Ray, please, approximately?
Yes, this was
2 years after Mariner, you said?
Yes, it was 19 December of 1965.
Okay.
And so these four courageous scientists came out to defy NASA and even testify before the U.S. Senate.
And that closed-door session, was that ever released?
Eventually kind of leaked out to the individual participants.
But not formally.
No, not formally. And mm-hmm. here's what some of them had to say. Dr. Berkner said, Venus may well be the abode of some kind of life. Dr. Herbert Friedman said, Venus may be as lively as she is beautiful. Conditions near the planet's cloud tops are favorable for the development of living molecules.
Uh-huh.
We have noted the possibility that Venus possesses high mountain ranges with moderate temperatures.
That's a key expression. High mountain ranges with moderate temperatures. Right.
Yes, and Venus has two mountain chains. One is about the size of the Rocky Mountains, and the other one is much bigger than any other on Earth.
Uh-huh.
So it's very mountainous. Very mountainous world.
Well, the formal declaration here about what Venus is or isn't says, roughly two-thirds of the Venusian surface is covered by flat, smooth plains that are marred by thousands of volcanoes, some of which are still active today, ranging from about 0.5 to 150 miles wide, with lava flows carving long, winding canals up to more than 3,000 miles in length, longer than on any other planet. So it does sound like a hellacious place. The planetary size of Venus compared to Earth is it's almost a match. It's very close.
Yes, yes, very close. And doesn't some of those facts seem very strange that they're reporting? They're saying it's a huge world covered with vast plains, yet they're talking about all these volcanoes. And then isn't it
true?
It contradicts, of course.
Yeah.
It contradicts them, their very selves. And then isn't it true that on Earth, when there's volcanic activity, like in the 19th century, when Krakatoa near Bali in the Pacific blew up, then the temperatures worldwide went into a mini ice age?
Right.
Because the particulate matter from the volcanoes was blocking the rays from the sun.
Hey, everything cooled off. You got it.
So rather than a greenhouse effect, Venus should be
an ice cube.
They should open up a ski chalet over there.
That's right. Here's a little more. This is interesting for a number of reasons. With conditions on Venus that could be described as infernal, the ancient name for Venus, which is, do you know what the ancient name for Venus is?
Cytherea.
Lucifer.
Oh, okay. Well,
the ancient name, this is from the ancient world. The ancient world's name for Venus is Lucifer.
Yes, from the Latin, Lucifer is just a word which means
light bringer.
Light bearer, light bringer.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so the fact that Venus was the third brightest object, only surpassed by the moon and the sun.
Right.
And in fact, Venus is so bright in its magnitude that you could actually see your shadow from it on a really clear night.
No kidding. Like moonlight, you can get Venusian light and get it generates a shadow?
You can get a shadow from Venus light on a clear night.
That's wild. Didn't know that.
And so the Romans... the Romans said that Venus must be the bringer of light.
Huh. Well, okay. So we got a good overview, a little sketch there for everyone about Venus. And the big story is that Valiant Thor, purportedly, along with his crew members, came from Venus. And I will ask you again to keep in mind and contemplate how little is ever said about Venus. Saturn, Mars, Pluto even, especially Mercury. We hear things about other planets, but we don't hear things about Venus. Jupiter, big news out there in space. Nothing about Venus. Suspicious.
Yes, it is very suspicious. And then, in my Venus 2 book, Rockets to Venus, I explore the massive Soviet program to discover life on Venus and what they were doing. There's a United States Air Force project that I published information from their document called Project White Stork. And they were monitoring what the Russians were doing to find out about Venus.
All right. Tell me some more about probes to Venus. I don't remember NASA sending a probe to Venus. Geez, maybe since Mariner. It's been a long time. I know they have sent a few, but I can't remember them or what they did.
Yes, there have been a few, but not as many as the Russians, because we've split our research up into sending them just about everywhere. But the Russians were on to the fact that something was going on with Venus, and they sent the majority of their probes.
How many have they sent?
They sent about 30 of them that we know of.
The Russians have spent a lot of money and sent 30 probes to Venus. Never heard about them.
And they were the first to land, to actually land.
That I remember. That I do remember, but I couldn't tell you in two sentences what I know about Venus other than what I just quoted. And thanks to you, we have this data. In your books, you have compiled not only scientific data, but data relating to Venus as purportedly from Val Thor and the others. Did Frank Stranges spend much time in his book about Venus? Did he describe it? Did he talk about it very much?
He basically just quoted what Val Thor had told him in the Pentagon.
Give me a quick thumbnail of that. What did he tell him?
Well, he was saying that the planet was existing in our third dimensional level as an underground civilization. So they built cities, vast cities and networks in the lava tubes.
So they did. So they went ahead and used the lava tubes. Interesting. That I didn't know.
Yes, played out lava tubes. And then they also had facilities on the surface.
Uh-huh. All right. Very good. Let's continue now. Are there any plans in the works? I'm going to wrap up this NASA angle here in a minute, to send any more probes to Venus that you know about? I've heard nothing. Or about the Russian sending?
Yes. As far as the United States, they're going to launch a high-altitude platform. Our plans are underway, and they have
They're going to orbit the planet, and it'll be a continuing, ongoing scientific platform.
Yes, but they're going to build it within the atmosphere, not in the orbit. Not in orbit. It's actually going to be a floating platform.
And how's it going to float?
It's a balloon platform, and I have the details of it in the Venus 3 book.
How's that going to work? How are they going to make something that'll float up there that won't burn up from the heat, the alleged heat?
They say that the upper atmospheric deck is that you could even breathe the atmosphere, and that the temperatures are moderate because it's so high up. But give me a break! It's the exact opposite on the Earth in the ionosphere. You couldn't live up there.
On our
world. So maybe they're going to put it on the surface.
I don't know. How weird. I wouldn't trust them anyway. I think you're right. They may well land it on the surface.
Yeah,
how are we going to know?
Yes, and that's why I call them NASA, never a straight answer.
Never, never, never. All right, hold on just a second. We'll be right back and continue with this fascinating discussion about Venus. And we have much to cover, so don't go away. Take a look at the links under Ray's name. Ray, and look under his name, you'll see the Val Thor notebook. Some wonderful photographs in there of Valiant Thor and his three crew mates. They're all there, and they're at that meeting we've discussed earlier. That was
13th of July, 1958.
Yeah, 58. Okay. The year before Errol Flynn and Mario Lanza died. Just a little footnote there. Do you know Errol Flynn and Mario Lanza passed away within the same week?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, you probably could have gone a lot further without knowing it, but I thought I'd toss that out there.
Oh.
Okay. Now, being an Errol Flynn fan, you know, and These pictures are very interesting. There are also some handwritten messages. We'll get there in a little bit. Let's continue on. The idea that Venus is habitable is a very intriguing idea indeed. Could NASA have covered this all up for all these decades? You betcha.
Yes. And Jeff, as we were talking before about the proposed floating city, it's known as the High Altitude Venus Operational Concept, codenamed HAVOC.
Yeah, that's good.
This is from my Venus 2 book. It would entail sending a robot to Venus to evaluate the possibilities of building a floating cloud city, something akin to a massive blimp in Venus' atmosphere. As it turns out, however, the Venusian atmosphere is an exciting destination for further scientific study and future human exploration, well worth the measly $3,000 more than the expenditures on other projects. For starters, a lighter-than-air vehicle will carry either a host of instruments and probes or a habitat and ascent vehicle for a crew of two astronauts to explore Venus for up to a month. John D. Reeves, the NASA official with oversight authority of the project under the auspices of the Space Agency's System Analysis and Concepts Directorate, declared that the mission requires less time to complete than a crewed Mars mission, and the environment at 50 kilometers is relatively benign, with similar pressure, density, gravity, and radiation protection to the surface of the Earth. Well, it goes on to a few pages to explain this project, and then some of the politicians and various interest groups, what they have to say about it.
Very good. Now, if you look again under guests, and please do, there are some links there. The first link is the Val Thor notebook, which we want to go through. The third link, Dr. Keller's books, and we've repeated the rare photos of Valiant Thor in that third link. The second link is called Cosmic Ray. That's a very nice article from Graffiti Magazine. You read all about it. It honors Ray's work. You have put more books out than on Venus than probably anybody else in the common nomenclature of publishing about extraterrestrial planets. Would you have had any acknowledgement from any scientists about your work in these books? As you've talked to a lot of people. What do people think about your books, those who are in the business of extraplanetary studies? Have you gotten any good response?
Yes, Dr. Michael Santini, who worked with NASA, and he's now a minister in the Assemblies of God. He wrote a really nice review of my book on Amazon.
Very good. All right. So let's just for fun open that link, Cosmic Ray, The Wizard of Venus, and let's take a look at some of these things on that link. All right, go down and look under guests. It's the second link. You can't miss it. So open that up, and it's written by Alan Zanjani, Graffiti Magazine, which I've heard about, by the way. It says, Morgantown Venus author is Supergirl's oldest fan. Okay, maybe not necessarily the oldest, but they're talking about long-standing fan. What is it about Supergirl that got you interested in the early days, going back to obviously when you were a kid?
Well, I've always liked Otto Binder and his work at DC Comics. He created Saturn Girl, the Legion of Superheroes, wrote a lot of Superman stories about life on Krypton and Superboy and Smallville and so forth. But he created Supergirl and Miss Marvel. While I was a young person reading and collecting these comic books, I didn't realize until after I started publishing the Flying Saucer Report and trading publications and information with Gabriel Green and Gray Barker and others, that Otto Binder wrote five books about flying saucers.
Oh, that is interesting.
And he was the creator of the hybrid extraterrestrial hypothesis, that the reason that the Venusians and other extraterrestrials are coming to Earth is to not only lead us onto the space age, but they were also interested in human beings on an individual level.
All right. Well, this is interesting. Now, Otto also had, as you mentioned, a comic book out called Saturn Girl. I don't want to get too far afield here, but was that dealing with somebody on Saturn, or was Saturn Girl over here on this planet?
Saturn Girl was in the 30th century, and there was an organization that is to be founded in the future, in the comic book universe anyway, for extraterrestrials living on Earth that band together to help protect and advance humankind. And then a lot of Otto Binder's articles he published in Argosy magazine and other publications. His motto was that UFOs are leading humankind into the space age.
Well, there may be some truth to that. This is very interesting. Argosy magazine and a number of others, Adventure, True, I've forgotten the names of them, I used to know. They were out in the 40s and 50s. And like the National Enquirer and the other tabloids, there were a lot of very provocative articles in there, and I think that they were used by various agencies to leak material to the public. I think there were platforms for that, as well as just, we'll call it just pop entertainment back then. Agree?
Yes, I definitely agree. I had the document that I got from Earl Neff. Earl Neff was the director of the Cleveland Ufology Project. It was the Air Force Academy's textbook by Major Carpenter, Chapter 23, about unidentified flying objects. And he announced that this document existed back in the pages of the National Enquirer.
Right.
And then, he gave the copy of it to me. He got it from Major Donald E. Kehoe. And then... And I forwarded it to a reporting center in Washington State.
Now, let me ask you a question, Ray. Since you were on last, the Pentagon story came out about the $22 million in total that was spent on a secret project to identify unidentified aerial phenomena or aerial threats, potential threats. We then come up with this fascinating digital video from apparently an F-18, that's what they say, off San Diego. There, I believe, were two aircraft flying. They were on a patrol, and they were told to investigate something. They were flying off the Nimitz. Both pilots have been available for interviews. I saw one interview on one of the network stations done by a complete imbecile, a moron. He didn't know anything about the story. He didn't know how to ask questions of this second pilot now who has come forward. You heard his voice in the digital recording, the video of the object, which looked like a tic-tac captured in the view screen of the F-18 Super Hornet. So these people are out there. Now, nobody is sure where the actual video came from. I haven't seen any evidence of what department the Pentagon had this video in it and how it was released to the Pentagon. But it's out there now. I've never seen more impressive gun camera footage officially released, however it was released. And I think that what we're seeing here potentially is the beginning of what is commonly called disclosure. We can also call it, I think, with equal justification, confirmation, because that's what it really is all about. We're just confirming officially what I think most of us either know or certainly suspect. What did you think of that footage and the story itself as it came out?
It looks authentic to me. It looks like some kind of a space vehicle, and it's definitely not one of ours. Although there was some speculation that it could have been something from Elon Musk, but I doubt it.
Oh, no.
I doubt it seriously because the maneuverability and what that object was doing.
Musk's ego is big, but it isn't that big.
So looking at it, I would say that this is the beginning of a lot of disclosure that's going to be taking place. Because as we're on the cusp now of actually going to other planets within the next 20-25 years.
Well, that's formal and official, but I think unofficially many of us suspect that we've been to other planets long ago, that we have advanced technology, black budget tech, deep space craft. And perhaps even we've been given rides here and there by others. So there's a lot going on. And if this is a disclosure confirmation effort, we'll be right on top of it here. Believe it. You'll hear it here, and we're going to bring it as succinctly and as quickly as we can to you if it continues. And I think we're going to see more. I do. So we'll find out.
Yes, this is so important because we're about to, on a more active, proactive level, regular people to be in contact with what Ted Owens and Otto Binder used to call space intelligences. So this is certainly one way of preparing the people for it, and if not. You know, even the ever since 1977 and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, I think even Hollywood has played some part in illuminating the consciousness
of
the American taxpayers.
If you think about it, Hollywood has been conditioning and programming and preparing the masses since the 1950s with motion pictures. It's never stopped, and if we're not ready now to be taken to the, quote, next level, end quote, we never will be. I think we're more than ready.
Oh, yes, Jeff. I don't think a lot of people realize that for example, the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yep.
And then the following, that was 1951, and then a couple years later, Patricia Neal was in this. The sequel to that, but it was made in the United Kingdom, called Visitor from Venus. And Desmond Leslie, who was the co-author of Adamski's book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, British Book Center, 1953, he was a British member of the British royal family and also a cousin to Winston Churchill. He was the technical consultant for those movies.
Wait a minute. Patricia Neal was in a sequel? Was it billed as a sequel?
Yes. It was called A Visitor from Venus.
I'll be darned. So did it pick up sort of where the other one left off?
Yes, it left where the other one left off, and it sort of parallels what happened with Val Thor, but in this case, a scout craft is handicapped, being caught up in some magnetic disturbance and has to come down in the British countryside. And then the gentleman seeks refuge in an inn, and then the British military forces are out looking for him. It turns out he doesn't have fingerprints and he could do all these amazing things. It's really quite an interesting movie.
So it's a you'd call it a worthy successor?
Well, if it was made in America, it probably would have been a little more glossy, you know. But
right.
Take the
Visitor from Venus or Stranger from Venus?
I think it's
1954.
It might be Stranger from Venus.
I'm looking it up here as we're talking.
And then the other movie was where Major Donald E. Kehoe. He was an aviation writer for True Magazine and a retired Marine Corps major. He became the director of National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was the largest UFO group by the end of the 1950s. He served as a technical consultant for another popular science fiction movie in the 1950s, 1956, I believe, Earth versus the Flying Saucers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. So what you said here is interesting. There's a review, hold on, about this film, which is Visitor or Stranger from Venus, 1954, directed by Burt Balaban. And one of the reviews, this is, hold on here, I got to read this. Well, he writes, what do you know? The second film from the Watch the Skies box set is also a derivative of The Day the Earth Stood Still, just like The Cosmic Man was. And just to make sure, the producers hired The Day the Earth Stood Still's female lead, Patricia Neal. Just like The Cosmic Man, this movie is mostly talk and very little tech. Well, we do get a saucer, but it looks about as high-tech as the saucers in Plan 9 from Outer Space. Okay. It's not an awful movie, but it isn't. It hasn't aged very well. Viewers accustomed to today's filmmaking would probably be buried in tears. Personally, I found it mildly interesting, but unless you're a 50s genre movies completist, you might as well skip this one. But interesting that they did that. I didn't know that Patricia Neal was, you know, a very celebrated actress.
Oh, yes. And, well, if you're into the contactees and everything, it's an ideal
Well, I'm sure it probably is. It's underrated here in the reviews. I think you may be right. I'll try and see it sometime. Very good. Okay.
On a purely intellectual level, the movie has a lot to say about Venusians and other interplanetarians, other Solarians.
Well, it says there's a box set of books, too, that this is the second of that box set. So somebody was avidly writing about science fiction, for sure. All right, I'm talking now, I'm quoting from the second link under Dr. Raymond Keller, Ph.D., it's called Cosmic Ray, and we're kind of going down that page a little bit. It begins with an article written by Alan Zanjani about Ray. Then there's a photograph of Ray, if you're not watching, sitting next to a table full of books. And then there's a photo of you and a young lady. Who is this young lady?
Oh, she works with me at In Touch and Concern. Her name is Kara, mm-hmm. which is interesting because Supergirl's character is Kara Zor-El.
K-A-R-A? Kara?
K-A-R-A, and so I nicknamed her Supergirl.
Very good. And so she works with you today?
No, she's not there at the present time.
I see. Okay. All right. Caption of the photograph, the doctor steps out of his backwoods TARDIS, whatever the hell TARDIS is, with local Morgantown friend Kara Supergirl George. Very nice. Okay.
Yeah, the then, TARDIS is the time-spanning vehicle that Doctor Who uses to...
Oh, I didn't ever watch Doctor Who. I missed that. All right. Where I was working. Then we've got a National Enquirer article, which is entitled, Sighting UFO Sparks Two Teenagers in the Publishing of Flying Saucer Magazine. So who are these two teens?
Oh, that's myself and Alan Weston. We co-edited the Flying Saucer Report in the mm-hmm. 1960s, and we received correspondence from all over the world and traded publications and information. And that's when I began building up my UFO files. And that article is about Oh, maybe 50 years old.
No shortage of reports in the 1960s. That's when the lid became pretty obvious, and it started to come down on the whole phenomenon. It began to recede from the mass media in the 60s. And by the 70s, it was gone.
And you're right, Jeff, and that was because in 1969, Dr. Edward U. Condon, a physicist in charge of the Air Force contracted report with the University of Colorado, generally called the Condon Report, recommended that Project Blue Book be closed and that the United States get out of the government anyway, get out of the UFO business. So for a while, that pretty much put the nail in the coffin.
Well, that's like the day that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates announced that the remote viewing project called Stargate didn't work and they were disbanding it. So, pretty silly.
Well, I had a bumper sticker with my group OSIRIS out in Hillmar, California, and it said, flying saucers are real, the government is an illusion.
Oh, I like that. Very good. I'll never forget that news conference by Gates, though. He announced that, yes, we did have a remote viewing program called Stargate, but it didn't work nearly well enough to warrant continuing it, which means it went black at that point, obviously. Okay, the next picture is of Ray. Nice-looking mustache, Ray, too, by the way. And the bee on your back. When we come back, we'll talk about this bee just sitting there, obviously enjoying the decor and not minding having its picture taken. So hang on, we'll come right back with Dr. Ray in just a minute. Smoke, odors, mold, bacteria, and viruses, and more, and will put extra oxygen into your bloodstream and clean your body just by you being there. I hope you'll drop by and visit GoHealthyNext.com and take a look. The prices are more than affordable, and the results are priceless. That's GoHealthyNext.com.
Known worldwide as the most consistently fascinating, informative, and unique program on radio, the Jeff Rentz program can be yours to listen to anytime, anywhere, whenever you want to hear it. For pennies a day, our subscribers can download any of Jeff's thousands of programs featuring a treasury of newsmakers, researchers, eyewitnesses, and incredible subjects, all in MP3, commercial-free, crystal-clear 56-bit digital sound, and take these often unforgettable programs with them wherever they go. As a subscriber, you can also listen live at airtime, online, anywhere in the world, or browse through our archives of over 6,000 hours of legendary broadcasts. Subscribe now by taking the link at the top of Rentz.com and enrich your mind with the most unique panorama of vital information and the best independent, honest journalism in radio. Look for the Subscribe Now link on Rentz.com and give yourself the knowledge you need for these unprecedented times.